Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome everyone to another episode here at the Damage Report in what is going to be the most bittersweet of Damage Reports, which we'll get to the reasoning for that shortly. But first, my co-host, it's Wednesday and it is a Big News Wednesday, but not a JR Big News Wednesday. No, it is an Emma Vigeland Big News Wednesday. Emma, how's it going?
Going good. Hump day news. That's what you should call it instead.
If I do, can I say it that way? Hump day. Hump day.
Hump day news.
I want to make sure that our viewers are feeling uncomfortable, basically. So I think we've got there.
Right.
We've got there. Well, look, it's been a bit since you've been on, and we're a week out from the election, so we're very glad you made time to join us. Thank you for that.
Thank you for having me. I wouldn't want to spend my day any other way, specifically this day.
Thank you. Well, you know what? You've sort of broached it there. Why don't we launch into this? Everyone, we have a big announcement to make. The announcement has already been made, but not inside of TDR, and that's really what I care about. So, Emma, you have been on the show many times. You've served as a co-host many times. You've been working for TYT for a number of years. What's going on?
Today's my last day. I am moving on to join the Majority Report and Sam Seder as co-host and a producer. I am super excited about this opportunity, but I don't want to, I don't want to cry actually. TYT has meant so much to me. I wouldn't be in this industry if TYT didn't take a chance on me. I'm the luckiest person in the world to have worked with wonderful people like John and Cenk and Anna and JR and Brett and everybody behind the scenes too. And John, start talking. Yeah.
Okay, I will. You know, it's been sad because I've known about this for 2 weeks now, I think, and it's so bittersweet, right into the heart lobes, because you know, obviously could not be more excited for Emma. You know, being a co-host of Majority Report is gonna be amazing. You are gonna make Majority Report 300% better by you transitioning there, so that's awesome. You know, just you having more screen time, a bigger platform is not only great, but it's as deserved as anything has ever been deserved. So obviously very glad, but I'm not going to pretend that, you know, that this isn't this is kind of devastating for me personally, for TDR, for TYT. We love having Emma on. You know, I've made that very clear in the past. I'm gonna probably reiterate a lot of those reasons spontaneously in a minute or two. But so it is bittersweet. It is both bitter and sweet. That's what you've given us, Emma.
Yeah, no, I mean.
I know it's sad, but it's okay. It's okay. You know what? If there's some residual tears later on during the news, people are just gonna think, hey, it's 2020, so don't even worry about that. Let me
These people at TYT are authentic. They're great. You know, they're in LA, I'm in New York. It was just a perfect marriage for me to join Majority Report so I could build something here where I'm from. But I when I do visit LA, these are my friends for life. They're the best, and John is the best. And I'm so grateful to have had the opportunity to work alongside you guys for as long as I have. So that's how I feel. And you successfully got me to cry. Congratulations, John.
Thank you. That's all I was hoping for. No, the honor is ours. Obviously, you being all the way in New York is difficult. There's really no situation at TY. Like, we have people who work in other areas, but not generally talent that work in other areas. And so that obviously has been hard. So it makes perfect sense in that way. But let me just really fast say, obviously, I've gone on at length a bunch of times about why I have so much respect for Emma and how much she's grown and evolved and become so amazing over literally just like 4 years or so. But really fast, you mentioned there that TYT is authentic. I think you said that your friends at TYT are authentic. You know, but see, that's the thing about Emma, is that I think authenticity is one of the most important values at TYT. And I would argue that she has capped out on that. Like Emma's not only smart and hardworking and all of that, but she's brave in a way that a lot of people aren't in media. And she's braver than me, by the way. Let me just clearly say that.
That's Emma, not true.
No, it is. It is. Emma relishes telling people things that are true and that will not necessarily make her more popular. I think that I do it somewhat. I don't do it as much as you, Emma. You do it more. Like all of us in 2016 who gave our honest appraisal of what needed to happen that election, we were attacked for it for literally years. A lot of people did the easy thing and told people what they wanted to hear. But you have just done that more and more. You are willing to take on cults of personality and, you know, grift cults and all of that. And you know, you have a lot of great qualities, but your bravery and willingness to do that when it could potentially hurt your audience in the future, I think is one of your greatest qualities. I really do admire that.
Thank you. I mean, there is not a smarter person, not a nicer guy, not a better friend than John. And there's no one more deserving of success. So I am going to constantly plug TDR until the end of time. And, you know, not too much is going to change. We're still going to be in contact and texting and talking about stupid pop culture things and movies. And I'm going to visit. I just have to because I love you guys too much.
We're going to be doing even some of that pop culture stuff a little bit later on. Maybe we'll be lucky enough. I don't know what your contract is like, but maybe you can come and do a game night with us or a common room or something like that. But really fast, in addition to all that I've said, Emma's been here for like more than 4 years now, and Emma has been a ridiculously important part of this period of TYT. She's grown a ton. She's turned Rebel HQ into this massive thing that I at TDR always have to be watching and worried about because it could be coming for me. And by the way, Adrienne Lawrence is going to be taking over that. We're going to have her on the show and talk about that and all of that, the future of the channel. But it's really important to me that people know that while a lot of people have transitioned from TYT to other things, they have not always done so on the best of terms, but Emma's leaving on literally the best terms ever. And it would really, like, I can't speak for you. I don't know. It's important to me though that people know what you were for TYT and how important you were and all of that. And so I decided to reassure you, to make sure that nobody forgets that you were here, I wanted to reassure you, and I'm going to do it in the language of your people because Emma's a jock through and through. So I asked for a little bit of advice from Brett, and we came up with an idea.
You didn't tell me you were going to do this. You said this was not in the rundown.
Well, I'm adding it. It's a last minute addition. So we're going to be retiring your jersey here, and just no one in the future of TYT, as long as I'm here at least, is going to be able to have the name Vigeland or the number 12. You got to choose a different name, a different number, deal with it. And you know what? I think I'm actually going to put this back here for the show today. We're just going to break a few things, but she's going to be a part of this thing. So people are going to remember, damn it.
What is wrong with you? What is wrong with you?
Anyway, Emma, we're also gonna have a jersey sent to you because a present you don't get to hold is no real present. But this is for us. We're keeping this one, but we're gonna send you one as well. And Emma, you're gonna be missed. I already miss you, and I'm literally talking to you right now. So hopefully we'll still be able to talk. Hopefully.
That's, you know, so nice, and I don't even know what to say. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, and you're one of the best.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
The national super spreader tour continues. Donald Trump's closing argument to the American people, "I will give you COVID." And he did what he could. And let's see what he had on offer for his rally audience yesterday. He had this little update on his strategy for the pandemic.
"We will vanquish the vaccine and we will get rid of this whole thing. We will get rid of this virus. It'll be very, you watch. It's going to happen very quickly."
Okay, I don't know what vanquish the vaccine meant. I assume it was just misspeaking, you know, the sort of thing that people do. And because Donald Trump is always so understanding of other politicians who misspeak from time to time, I'm gonna give a pass on that one, Emma. He just misspoke about vanquishing the vaccine.
Doesn't he kind of seem like he already knows that what's gonna happen? I mean, look, we all know they could contest it in the Supreme Court. The voting totals could be very unclear on election night, which could cause mayhem. I think that's a likely scenario, honestly. But he doesn't even have the same energy when he goes to his rallies. Like, this man, he knows it in his bones that he is not gonna get enough votes, most likely, you know, knock on wood. Doesn't that seem like the case to you, John? That's kind of the vibe I'm getting from him.
Yeah, it's a very sort of defensive vibe. He's literally a bit lower energy, you know, potentially from the COVID thing.
Low energy, John. Low energy, Don.
Low energy. He's got low D. He's got low D. Sorry, there's medicines that'll deal with that. But you know, from the news of White House insiders already pointing the finger at who's responsible to Ben Shapiro saying, you know, like talking about, you know, what it would mean if he lost to Biden. Again, nothing is for sure, and go vote if you haven't already, obviously. But he's not acting like a person who expects that the American people are gonna choose him.
Yeah, I mean, and just to bring it back to what he's saying about coronavirus, it's because none of these lies that he told in the form of fake promises are manifesting themselves. I mean, we don't have a vaccine and election day's on Tuesday. We haven't eradicated the coronavirus. It hasn't magically disappeared. It didn't disappear when it was Easter. It didn't go away over the summer. And now it's as bad as it's ever been, directly because of his strategy of ignoring the virus, downplaying it constantly like a PR stunt, and not being a leader. And people are connecting those dots. There's no way to just blow past COVID-19 because it's affecting everybody and it's the daily reality paired with the economic depression that it's caused. So he can't do his normal, "I'm just gonna change the conversation to Ted Cruz's dad killing JFK or Hunter Biden's laptop," which, by the way, the right-wing media machine here, the propaganda apparatus, seems to be a little bit broken. That story makes no sense and it's not connecting in the way it did with Hillary Clinton. So a lot of things are going badly for him. He can't use his usual tactics because in times of crises, people want a leader, which he's incapable of doing fundamentally.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think part of it was that they spent more time on the Hillary thing, but a lot of it was just, I think there were a lot of people who were ready to believe whatever bad thing about Hillary. They didn't like her, they didn't trust her for some good reasons and some BS reasons. And so that was the skeleton that you can graft any number of conspiracy theories on. But with Joe Biden, you know, in the words of Kayleigh McEnany, he's warm, he's funny, he's a man of the people or whatever. And so it's a little bit harder to get these conspiracy theories to stick, especially when like your point man on them, Donald Trump, he has no idea what the theory is. Like to hear him talk about this Biden laptop thing, I don't know if he thinks that like he's got like a pirated copy of Fallout 76 on it. He has no idea what the story actually is. So regular people really aren't going to eat that thing up. The one area I wanted to correct you on was you implied that the vaccine wasn't gone by Easter, it wasn't gone by summer. I don't know exactly what day it was gone, but apparently it is gone. Because the White House's science policy office today ranked ending the COVID-19 pandemic as on the top of the list of Donald Trump's top first term accomplishments. So I guess it did end. I apologize. I guess I messed up because I didn't cover that story when it ended, but I guess it's over because that's what they said he did.
Well, you did mess up because you meant to say COVID-19, but you said vaccine like three times. So just correcting you on your own program so people know that you literally—
Get off my network.
You misspoke, so what a loser you are.
Okay, I'm gonna vanquish this vaccine any moment. Anyway, the truth is that the country set a new record of 83,000 cases in a single day. And the 7-day case average is now hovering around 70,000 cases, more than at any other time during the pandemic. You know, over. We've rounded the corner and oh God, there's virus over there. Anyway, over 42,000 people are now hospitalized with COVID-19, like right now. Like as I'm filming this, you know, was that half the Rose Bowl filled up with people who are in the hospital as a result of COVID-19? He's done. He's ended it. Ugh. I don't know. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it'll work. I don't know.
So like North Korea-esque.
Exactly.
He also doesn't go to the bathroom. He also doesn't go to the bathroom. That's what they say on the.
He doesn't defecate. He can go to the bathroom wherever he goes because he wears big boy pants. But anyway, we're not going to talk about that anymore. I'll let Francesca convince you next Monday. So let's talk about one other area of this. Donald Trump's closing argument in this campaign. He's had one group that he's really for the past few months tried to focus on, and that is suburban women. And he's got maybe one last pitch for them. And this campaign messaging is coming to you via the 1950s. Here he goes.
Because women, suburban or otherwise, they want security. They want security. They want safety. They want law and order. They have to have law and order. And we're going to do great. And I love women and I can't help it. They're the greatest. I love them much more than the men. Much more than the men. So I'm saving suburbia. I'm getting your kids back to school. Get your kids back to school. And you know what else? I'm also getting your husbands. They want to get back to work, right? They want to get back to work. We're getting your husbands back to work. And
what is going on?
Yeah, so is this Mad Men?
They love security. Yeah, seriously. I didn't watch Mad Men, so I might be. So
John, it's the best drama of all time. Go on.
Anyway, better than season 8 of anyway. So they want security. They want their kids to go back to school. I'm surprised number 3 isn't like, I'm gonna give you a rosé as much as you want. And then they want their husbands to go back to work. What the F is that? There's like 80 million American women in the workforce. Yeah. They work. And especially, you know, thanks to capitalism, they gotta. So no, they are going back to work as well. It's not just their husbands, you caveman. What the F?
I know. And what I love about this constant naked plea to suburban women is like, has there ever been a politician who just says the polling data that his team is giving to him, like very inartfully? They're telling him you need to win over suburban female voters. So he goes on the stump and goes, suburban women love me, do it. I mean, you usually have a little bit more finesse than that, but he just says what his campaign team is telling him. He's making inroads with suburban women. And then he goes on the stump, why don't you love me, suburban women? I mean, you would kind of have to first make the appeal to them instead of just calling out that specific demographic.
Yeah. I don't think that's the only example of what you're talking about, where he's given like a couple bullet points, like, oh God, we really need to get this group. And like that's given to him so that he can come up with some sort of set of policies or something to appeal to them. Instead, he just says it. So as you say, with suburban women, but also like he goes to Erie, Pennsylvania, and he's like, you know what? I don't even want to be here. I shouldn't have to be here. I guess I gotta be here. He did it in, I think, Nebraska as well. Some other state, he's like, I shouldn't even be here right now. He says that to the rally attendees in the freezing cold. He tells them, I don't want to be here, but I gotta because I'm losing in the polls. How could that possibly work? And it might. There's like a 10% chance that that strategy actually works.
Well, that part is like something about him that I know we actually, this might be our biggest disagreement, is appealing because he kind of speaks off the cuff and people like that about him. But that is not enough to save him here, John. I mean, he's... that off the cuffness is also in this time of crisis, a war on crisis.
Yeah. Right. So, and by the way, I don't know if maybe this is what you're talking. Like, he has this thing that they like. Would you like to, in your last appearance on TDR, for at least right now, would you like to defend his dancing?
Oh, I like the dancing. I thought it was funny. There is something to being authentically yourself in some way. People enjoy that. I thought the dancing was funny. Pretending he's not funny isn't gonna help matters. The fact that he's a monster gets in the way of him being funny, but he's funny. He's funny. There's something funny about Trump, John. This, we'll never agree on this. We'll never agree.
So here is the issue. Every joke has the setup and the punchline. So the is him doing this, I guess. But the setup for that punchline to work is convincing people that hundreds of thousands of Americans dying doesn't matter. And he did. Like if you look at, I was just covering a poll, only 24% of Republicans are gonna be supporting Donald Trump think that the pandemic is an important issue for this election. Like they have been successfully convinced that the pandemic doesn't matter, that people aren't really dying, that it doesn't matter if they do, it's totally cool. So they like his little thing like this.
No, I get that.
I'm so bothered by the setup that I don't like the punchline.
Right, but I'm not even
But you are okay with that because you're a monster.
Right. Well, obviously, this means I adore Trump and hope he wins 5 different terms into the end of time. I hope he's the emperor of the United States. But I just think, like, not in terms of joke punchline setup, but his existence and how ridiculous he is as a caricature is amusing. And some of the things he just blurts out, you're like, oh my God, you're so taken aback. I mean, the reason he was able to be a successful reality TV show host is because he's amusing and a character. So that's all I'm saying. And there is a segment of the population that is drawn to that, which is part of why he won in 2016 too.
Oh, I get it now. They're bringing you onto the majority report to provide some balance because you're now a red hatter. So there's good. They want that perspective, just in case he wins. They want that perspective from the MAGA head. Right.
They're going full CNN, and they're gonna have me on as the Rick Santorum figure.
That's the path you were always going in. Let's be honest here. Anyway, somebody's like, John, don't choose Emma as your garbage person for position on his dancing. We'll see. Tune in Friday. Find out who my garbage person is. Maybe it's Emma on her last week. Maybe I throw her jersey into my trash can. Anyway.
After breaking my heart with that sweetness, do not even joke about it.
Okay. Okay. Let's move on with a little bit more from that rally. Donald Trump's rally was an opportunity for him to do one thing that he's been doing over and over, one last attempt to convince his crowds that he doesn't care if they live or die. So take a look at this video that he tweeted out comparing his rally with Joe Biden's. Okay, so now we had to take the music out of that. You should understand that the music they were playing in the video was Fortunate Son, which is a Vietnam era song, an anti-war song about how regular low and working class Americans had to go and fight and die in Vietnam. But people with economic and political power were able to get their fortunate sons to not have to go. And having this draft dodger helicopter in to Fortunate Son is just perfect. My theory is that Donald Trump, he's been cursed by a witch for a long time, and he can't play campaign songs that don't own him in some way for the rest of his life. And so, yeah, he's got this massive crowd. A bunch of those people are probably gonna end up getting sick. And were there any concerns about that? Well, now we're gonna go to that other video. Notice to the director. We've got Hogan Gidley being asked about hospital capacity since a lot of these rallies have ended up with spikes of coronavirus in their wake.
Hospitals in Wisconsin are near capacity. And so does that give you any pause, or the vice president any pause about going there and holding a big rally?
No, it doesn't. The vice president has the best doctors in the world around him. They've obviously contact traced and have come to the conclusion it's fine for him to be out on the campaign trail. The American people have the right under the First Amendment to peaceably assemble too. The fact is, we are seeing some good news about coronavirus.
Okay, so that I think is the ultimate Trump campaign message. Like, she asked, are you worried about the fact that people are getting sick after these rallies? And their answer is, no, we're gonna be cool. We've got doctors, we'll be fine. He didn't even apparently think about the fact that we're not talking about you, you big idiot. We're talking about the regular Trump supporters that are gonna get sick and go to the hospital and die as a result of it. Man, that is tone deaf. That is Kardashian tone deaf.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's inconceivable to them that they look out for the interests of the American people and aren't just thinking about themselves. I mean, again, that comes back to the entire coronavirus strategy. It's really remarkable how little they care about actually improving people's lives. And I know past Republican administrations, they at least thought and bought into their own ideology a little bit more and got high on their own supply. But the Trump administration, all they care about is the appearance of winning. All they care about is the appearance of success. And they're not even smart enough, or they don't even have enough fortitude to actually put in the work to achieve that success.
Yeah.
And so that's all we've seen with the coronavirus pandemic, and they're insular and only care about themselves. Who cares if people are getting sick at their rallies? All we care about is that the American people think we're doing a good job with coronavirus.
Yeah, and generally they're better at hiding the fact that they're only worried about their own lives. And Emma's not gonna know what I'm talking about here, but we have a theory. It's the Dr. Johnny Bananas theory, and it's that Donald Trump and high profile, high power Republicans are always gonna be protected from the consequences of everything, including things like COVID, because they get experimental monkey medicine that'll protect them from it. That's why he recovered so fast. That's why they're gonna be just fine. And the con is that they have convinced their followers that they will get the monkey meds, but they're not going to. Dr. Johnny Bananas is not coming to your hospital, to your tent with hospital beds that's been set up. You're not going to Walter Reed, dude. You're going to be left to die, as so many Americans have, as close to 1,000 still are every single day. And unfortunately, Dr. Johnny Bananas, that con has been working on the American people for some time. Hogan Gidley just sort of made it a little bit too obvious there. But anyway, if that wasn't clear enough for his rally goers, that you have a First Amendment right to go and then get sick, and we're not gonna do anything to stop that from happening. If COVID isn't bad enough, they've got a new way that their rally goers can die. And we found that out immediately after yesterday's rally, with NBC News reporting that hundreds of President Donald Trump's supporters were left in the freezing cold for hours after a rally at an airfield in Omaha, Nebraska on Tuesday night, with some walking around 3 miles to waiting buses and others being taken away in ambulances. According to dispatches from Omaha's police department, recorded by radio communications platform Broadcastify, at least 30 people, including the elderly, an electric wheelchair user, and a family with small children, were among those requiring medical attention after hours of waiting in the cold. One officer advised 8 to 9 elderly people. They said that there was an elderly party who was frozen cold, unable to move, with an altered mental status. Another officer over that communications thing said that they had an elderly male down. So they were, apparently they just didn't, either didn't plan well, didn't care to plan well. And so some of their rally attendees had to wait for hours and were literally being treated for hypothermia after Donald Trump had jetted away from that airfield.
Is that not the crystallization of everything we've been talking about there? I mean, I don't even know what to add to that.
Yeah, they don't care. Like, they don't care. And it's not just Trump. Mitch McConnell is adjourned. He's done. He's good. No aid, nothing. You know what? And the thing that's, I said this on the show yesterday, it's one thing to not care about helping the American people, but he is revealing to us how sure he is that it's not going to impact the election, at least as far as he and other embattled Republican senators are concerned. Like, he doesn't even need to pretend to care. He doesn't need to give a sham, tiny, ineffective aid bill. He doesn't need to do anything because they have set up a system where they feel like they can win no matter what, even if they leave people to suffer and die in the worst domestic catastrophe that we've had in our entire lives.
Well, he is running against Amy McGrath, so.
Yeah, that helps. That helps. Not too many weeks ago, we found out about the fact that at an ICE facility, a number of women were treated completely needlessly, indeed non-consensually, with operations up to and including complete hysterectomies. Some of those women were then deported out of the country before they could have any sort of legal proceedings having to do with these surgeries that they didn't ask for. And now we're finding out that the number was actually higher than we originally thought. There's some great reporting over The Intercept on this. I want to give you just a few standout statistics from it. At least 17 women treated by a doctor alleged to have performed unnecessary or overly aggressive gynecological procedures without proper informed consent remain in detention at Irwin County Detention Center. This is a privately run facility in Georgia housing US Immigration and Customs Enforcement detainees. So many of the women have been deported, but there's still a good number who are there that hypothetically congressional investigators and things like that could go and speak to. The total number of women known to have been seen by the doctor since 2018 who say they underwent or were pressured to undergo unnecessary treatments has risen to 57, a higher number than previously known. And apparently, since we first found out about this story back in September, thanks to a very courageous whistleblower, ICE has deported at least 5 women who were seen by that doctor. At least 2 more women may be deported this week. So look, is this just ICE deporting as many people as they can before the election, as they did with those Cameroonian refugees? We don't know. Or is it them trying to get rid of potential witnesses that could testify during congressional investigations? I don't know which of those it is. Both are horrendous, but I am glad that we are getting additional information about this incredibly tragic story.
Well, I think you're right about trying to shuffle people out of the country, because this is an enormous scandal. And part of why it's such a scandal is because eugenics like this is ingrained in American history. Forced sterilizations have been a part of American history and have been inflicted upon Black, Brown, and Native Americans for decades at this point, going back to the origins of the country. And so I see a lot of lefty, well, I would say more liberal pundits talking about, oh, the horrors of the Trump administration. And yes, that's part of it. But to understand the full scope of the atrocity, you have to know that this is a part of American life and American history, and it's living history right now. The medical racism is a huge thing in addition to just eugenics, right? There are still many doctors who, there have been studies, think Black people have a higher pain tolerance, things like that, where they will be less likely to give them pain medication. Obviously, Black mothers' mortality rates when they're giving birth are way higher than white people. And it extends to migrants and immigrants and people who come from a Latino background. We obviously saw this. So this is a part of a larger issue in American politics right now. And it's really, really grim and gruesome when you think about it. as a woman who wants to have children someday, the thought of thinking I was going to a doctor for a regular procedure and to have part of my uterus taken out and to be unable to have children, that is so violent and gruesome to think about. I mean, it makes my blood boil. And I cannot believe that this was done, or I can believe it, but it's so angering to know that this was done on a mass scale.
Yeah, you know, to that point, let me read you one of the worst graphics that I think I've ever read on the show because of one particular part. So the Intercept spoke to one of these women, Yuridia, who was deported 3 days after undergoing an operation she said she did not comprehend, did not consent to. She was dumped into Mexico, not knowing what happened to her, still bleeding, wondering if she still had a uterus, according to her attorney. And that's our government. That's what they left a woman to suffer.
We're
and
shining beacon
die.
Of light. We're a city on a hill. We're a city on a hill, John. Yeah, we're just a force for good in the world. And that's why we should invade all these other countries, right? Because our morals are so in lockstep with Jesus here at home. Thank you, Mike Pence and Donald Trump and the whole Republican administration for pretending like the United States is better than other people. No, this is what we do. This is who we are.
Yeah, and my hope is that something is going to be done about this. The story got a good bit of traction immediately, you know, exclusively on centrist to left media. The right didn't have a problem with this whatsoever. You didn't see a single pro-life person saying, hey, wait, you can't just rip someone's uterus out without them saying you can. For some reason, abortions are the most important political issue anyone could ever imagine, but stealing uteruses is not a big deal. But it is also a time of a lot of news happening. And so my fear was that nobody's really on watch for this sort of thing. It'll be a big media story and then everyone will move on. Now, hopefully that's not happening. Last Friday, 8 members of Congress, including Representative Ocasio-Cortez, Omar, Tlaib, Presley, sent a letter to United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, outlining concerns about gynecological procedures on women in Irwin. But in terms of Congress doing something to stop it, I mean, first of all, if Tuesday doesn't go the right way, literally nothing will be done. This will expand even more. They'll have even less worry about investigations and things like that. But I hope that someone is on this for when Biden gets in. There's a billion things Biden has to do, but this can't fall by the wayside. That doctor is still out there. That doctor is not behind bars right now. So the tragedy is what happened to the women, but the culprits are still there. All the people who've raped so many women in these facilities and abused them and extorted them and all that, many of them are still serving right now in these facilities waiting to prey upon more women. And we can't let this just get swept away by the flood of news that comes out every week.
Abolish ICE. This organization was not around for a long time. It was created and has been abused after many of our human rights were trampled on in the post 9/11 world. So this is the kind of thing that needs to end. We can live without a force like this, an unaccountable immigration police force that has clearly abused and violated countless migrants and people who just are trying to come for a better life. It's revolting and it's time. Abolish ICE.
People tried to act like AOC was crazy for pushing that.
Oh yeah, right. I know. It's like these people who think they're intellectuals can't see past what, like 20 years of the history of ICE. They can't just imagine a world where it didn't exist. You pretend to be smart and yet the scope of your imagination is the size of a pinhole.
Yeah. Okay, let's mix things up. We're gonna roll right through into our next story, which is we're gonna be going effectively from as serious a political story as can be to basically the news headline of what 2020 is. So we're gonna be talking about Rudy Giuliani. So let's turn to that now. Rudy Giuliani was on Fox Business. He was being interviewed by Kennedy, who has a show on Fox Business. That is something I'm learning. We're also learning about Rudy Giuliani's increasingly fragile and chaotic mental state, because he did not respond well to some of the questions and comments and insinuations from Kennedy. So buckle up, hold on to your butts. We're gonna show you a little bit of Rudy Giuliani, including how he responded to a sort of comparison she made to him and Christopher Steele.
Some could say that you were acting like Christopher Steele, that you were abstracting information, and because
you gotta be kidding me. I was acting like Christopher Steele.
That's what it sounds like when you look
apologize.
At the people.
You better apologize for that. I mean, I've been a United States attorney, associate attorney general, mayor of New York City, and a member of the bar for 50 years. I've never been accused of anything, and you're accusing me of being Christopher Steele?
I'm accusing you of acting in a capacity similar to Christopher Steele, and that you were going back and forth between Ukraine
and structure of justice
and the United States.
What you are saying is an outrageous defamation of me, of my reputation. Every single thing is here, and I want you to look at it, and then you apologize to me. Well, you can come to my office and you can look at it, and tomorrow night you can apologize to me for saying I'm like Christopher Steele. I told you there are underage girls there. There are. I told you there are documents that show that he's getting 10%. There are. There are documents that show that he's getting half of what Hunter gets. There are. And when they're there, I want you to apologize to me because you just defamed me.
Absolutely.
And that's outrageous because you have no basis for that. I came on your show in good faith to give you evidence that is being withheld from the American people, and I get defamed. That's outrageous.
All right. Are you still working on behalf of the president?
I think our interview is now over.
I haven't.
And that seems to be confirmation that he is working for the president, because he has the exact same relationship to interviewers as Donald Trump is. When he doesn't like it, he just walks away. So that was Rudy Giuliani operating in good faith.
He is a literal gremlin. I mean, he looks like the penguin, right? He looks like Danny DeVito, the penguin. He is one of the most evil people I have ever seen in American politics. He is a caricature of a human being. And by the way, you talk about she's impugning your character. Dude, you don't have a reputation left. Even most Republicans outside of the Looney Tunes in the Trump administration think you're a joke. I've seen him in person. He's completely round. He's like 5'5 and has nothing left in his brain except just black bile and nonsense and whiskey or whatever he's drinking. He is a crazy person. That's all I've got. This is my last day. That's what I'm saying. He is a nut job. I mean, it blows my mind that he's let on television. He should be in some sort of psych ward.
Yeah, the question is, why did she have him on? I mean, she's being a little bit critical of him. I have no idea what she says from day to day. For all I know, this was hour six of her coverage of the Hunter Biden laptops. I don't know. But you bring on Rudy Giuliani, he's gonna say crazy things. That's all he's capable of doing. You can't get mad at him for that. If I leave a slice of pizza on my floor, my dog eats it. That's not the dog messing up, that's me messing up. And Rudy Giuliani's effectively a pizza eating dog with black bile in his brain. And so he flipped out. Now it continues. So again, hold even further onto your butts, because he doesn't like the rest of the interview any more than he liked the insinuations about Christopher Steele.
Action in the Borat movie?
No, that's a stupid question, isn't it?
No, it's not stupid at all. I have a 15-year-old daughter. I watched that and I was kind of grossed out by it. I'm giving you a chance to explain.
Why was I called the police when I realized that it was a scam. I called the police and he ran away. Because the minute she said something compromising, I called the police. Whether you believe it or not, I was tucking my shirt in. He made it appear as if it was something different. The minute she said she wanted to give me a massage, I called my security guy and we called the New York City Police Department, who came there, and Borat, and his 50-man crew ran out of the place.
All right.
So that's what happened.
Finest.
Would you like to ask me any other
in the world?
Any other question to attack me for merely coming on your show to show you what criminals they are from a hard drive that's been verified by about 50 people, including the New York Post?
No, I'll see you tomorrow. Now, I'll read it for myself.
Like to insult me
I'll put my eyeballs on it. I can't wait. Thank you for your time,
Mr. Mayor. Well, maybe you should have done some research in advance.
I did a lot of research.
And listened to the tape recording. You sure didn't listen to the conversation that came out today in which Hunter Biden says in his own voice that he is partners with the chief Chinese spy master, Patrick Ho. Now, go figure out how I made that up.
All right.
See if you can come up with some creative theory how I made that up.
You can't tell me you haven't loved this conversation. You've loved it.
I have not loved this conversation. I find this conversation totally insulting.
I think he was probably speaking for the audience. I have not loved this conversation. But she did, because she was smirking at him literally that entire time. I guess that's why she brought him on, maybe, because she expected this sort of thing would happen.
Yeah, I mean, I still remember I think that was his Piers Morgan interview, where he got into a screaming match with Piers too. And Piers Morgan is not that good of a guy, but he makes Rudy Giuliani makes him look like Bernie Sanders.
Oh God, let me ask you one final question as to the substance of this. Is there any substance to this?
Yes.
And by that I mean, this is their attempt. The best they've got is Rudy Giuliani with a blind guy's laptop that supposedly shows that Joe Biden did whatever Q says, I guess. I guess he sleeps with children and he took $1 billion from China. I don't know. Is this helping him at all? And if so, to what extent is it helping Donald Trump?
Well, no, it's not helping Trump at all. And I alluded to this earlier in the show. The right-wing propaganda machine's kind of broken in 2020. A lot of things broke in 2020. And the Fox News right-wing smear machine, it's not working. This Hunter Biden thing is so convoluted. And it doesn't make sense. The initial claims about Burisma, which came out a long time ago, okay. Yes, there is clearly some sort of kind of corrupt deal where this Ukrainian energy company tried to get access to Joe Biden via his son. Well, the Trumps do it 100 times worse, so that's why this doesn't land. And also, all of the following conspiracy theories don't make any sense. So the initial thing was a relevant topic about corruption, right? If they were making it about that, but they try to make it about Hunter Biden's addiction, which was so tone deaf and horrible, leaking photos of him personally from his laptop. And then everything falls apart from there. No one can follow this. Not even the Fox News host, not even the people who are so in this right-wing media bubble. They can't even follow. Donald Trump doesn't even know what he's talking about when he talks about Hunter Biden on the stump. It's really a failed effort by the right-wing propaganda machine. And it's fun to watch.
It is fun to watch. And I think, yeah, ideally they would want it to affect the actual outcome, drive more people to the polls. Now, it seems to me, based on like Ted Cruz talking with Jack Dorsey or whatever today, it seems like they're just hoping to use it to put pressure on the tech platforms to even more favor them in the future, implying that like, how could Tucker Carlson talking to whoever the hell that was yesterday not trend? And if it didn't trend on Twitter, then clearly Twitter is biased against all conservatives. So it seems like that's sort of the backup plan. Is it would be great if it got people to the polls, probably not going to. Maybe we can at least get Twitter to be nicer to us. I don't know. Man, Giuliani, he thought he was gonna be president at one point. And now he can't make it through an interview with an MTV host. Kim Kardashian, a bit tone deaf, admittedly, during the pandemic. She tweeted this. After 2 weeks of multiple health screens and asking everyone to quarantine, I surprised my closest inner circle with a trip to a private island where we could pretend things were normal just for a brief moment in time. And then there are beautiful pictures of people in fancy clothes We danced, rode bikes, swam near whales, kayaked, watched a movie on the beach, and so much more. I realized that for most people, this is something that is so far out of reach right now. So in moments like these, I'm humbly reminded. Catch that before it was live.
I didn't either.
Right.
I didn't either.
Right now.
Yeah.
You think about it, a private island because of the pandemic.
Me renting a private island is a little bit out of reach on my budget, but maybe next year.
Right now, it's like, oh God, I just got so much money, but the pandemic. I'll just sit here with my money. No, that's not why. That's not why at all. And by the way, adding, I am humbly reminded of how privileged my life is. I get it. That's a good thing, especially in terms of marketing. But there ain't nothing humble about this. And acknowledging your privilege is not as good as not throwing your luxurious superhero Martian elite lifestyle in our face as we're worried about going to the supermarket without catching a disease that kills us or our loved ones. And she is a regular person. She can do whatever she wants. And admittedly, this is what she is famous for. A lifestyle that's crazy. That's what a lot of people are famous for some reason. I don't know why, as Americans, we've decided this is what people should be famous for, just being on the beach all the time and being on nice planes. I don't know. But she is the ultimate version of that. And it just strikes me as a little bit tone deaf as we launch into the third part of the first wave of COVID.
Oh, a little bit? Yeah, so look, I've been recently feeling a soft spot for Kim Kardashian. I said this to John, he didn't approve. I feel sorry for her that her husband clearly struggles mentally and had some sort of breakdown in public and seems to maybe be continuing that. I feel like she did do some good work trying to release people from prison. And I will admittedly tell you that I used to watch Keeping Up with the Kardashians. I like some trash reality TV. Sue me, The Bachelorette is crazy this season. Anyway, but yeah, this undid all of that. This was so embarrassing for her. What?
Totally too. I said, I'm gonna sue you actually. I can't afford a great lawyer, admittedly, but I do have Rudy Giuliani. And so you better watch your ass anyway.
But you can, but you are saving up for your private island, right?
Who needs to save up? Literally the only thing stopping me is this damn pandemic. But anyway, yes. I will say, I would have guessed that you'd watch Keeping Up with Kardashians. I will say that I too watch trashy reality, not that trashy, but I've recently restarted rewatching American Chopper from like a billion. Did you ever watch that?
No, what
is that? Reality, it's a reality show about this group of guys that make custom motorcycles and fight with each other a lot.
Oh, that's fun.
It's good though, it's good.
Wait, but anyway, I just have a quick thing because we're having fun. Oh, sorry. What? Did you have something else to say?
No. What's up?
Did you ever watch Pimp My Ride?
Yes, I've watched a little bit of Pimp My Ride.
Okay. There was once an episode where this woman was a nurse and they pimped her ride and they put what's the machine that you go in and like, you know, it's really claustrophobic.
You said shoot, that's fine. Sensory deprivation tank or an iron lung?
No, one where they scan you.
Oh, like an MRI?
Yes, they put an MRI machine in the back of her car. Why would that ever, it's not functional. Why would that ever be useful? And she's never gonna be able to sell that. Okay, I just had to get that off my chest.
No,
it's a reality TV show episode that's been in my mind for like 12 years at this point.
Have they rebooted that? They should reboot that. No. But anyway, okay, so look, her being a bit tone deaf, not necessarily good, but something good did come of this. The same thing that comes of everything these days, memes. And so people took her little tweet and made their own version of it. Yashar Ali did a photo version of a text that I, a tweet that I sent out with his edition of Castaway there. Someone went with Lost, actually, that was their little island trip that they took. Some people who are really into literature decided to go with Lord of the Flies. It would be funny if it devolved to that. But the best has to go to Ken Klippenstein with the photo from Parasite, because it's just so perfect in this year. And the best, what?
Sorry, I'm just saying the best always goes to Ken. He is the king of Twitter. I mean, there's no other way. Yeah. There's no way around.
I wish I was 1% as good. Yeah. You know who liked that tweet of his? The official Parasite account.
Awesome.
I guess they like it. If you haven't seen Parasite, watch Parasite instead of Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
That's a good idea. Good rule of thumb.
Yeah. Anyway, why don't we move on to our last story? Because we've got Kim Kardashian, and you brought up Kanye West's issues. What if Kanye West seems like the reasonable one today? So that is our transition into this story.
Whew.
Kanye West, over the weekend, I believe, was on the Joe Rogan podcast, and he was talking about the Star Wars prequels. And as soon as I saw this, I knew I had to hold this story for when Emma Vigeland would be on the show. So she's here now. Here's Kanye West on those movies.
And this is one thing I want to say, like, and this is about to make me mad right here. The first time you see me get mad in the interview. They said that George Lucas's prequels are worse than the corporate made Disney Star Wars.
I'll get mad at that too.
Like,
that's ridiculous.
Revenge of the Sith. We saw how Darth Vader was made.
Yeah.
Like, I watched that like 10 times during COVID. Like, don't jump, Anakin. No. I got the high ground.
Those early movies were pure. Yeah. They were pure.
I'm saying even the prequels are better than anything that. And I'm sorry, Disney Star Wars design team. I know you're gonna like put my face up in the, you know, office and be like, forget. No, man, this is George. This is his baby. That thing was set in his heart to show us as children the hero's journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and these like, how can we run it back and replay? Like, even at Disney, you know, there's people, you know, at Pixar that have left. People have left, you know, where. They call, I forgot the exact title, but saying like every time is a new idea, they call it like an unproven idea. So they'll get to Toy Story 800,000 and Frozen Trillion before there's a new concept.
Right. Okay, so really fast, I just want to say, when I say that he sounds reasonable, I don't mean that I agree with him. I don't at all, and I will explain that in a bit. But if I just watched that video of him, I would think, oh yeah, no, he's a perfectly normal, you know, intelligent human being expressing thoughts without sounding like a crazy person.
Yeah, you know, I have a soft spot for Kanye West. I feel like I have a soft spot for everybody because I still would put Kanye in my top.
You're
five
one big soft spot, Emma.
Yeah,
that's all
I know.
You are.
I'm
give
just
people the benefit of the doubt.
I'm schmaltzy. Yeah, but he's one of my top five favorite artists of all time. Of all time, and I also think he has like a good heart. What are you talking about? That's not a bad take. That's not even a bad take. His music's amazing. Mm. And not less so now, but yeah, like his album, early albums, Graduation, Last Registration. Yeah, okay. Anyway,
no, it's but not a music segment. This is a Star Wars segment. Damn it!
Right. Back to the important topic at hand. I love when he says the corporately made ones. Dude, you realize that the other movies were corporately made too?
Those were, no, right? Phantom Menace is indie, man. It was made on a budget of $2,300.
A24 was the production company behind those movies. No, okay, I do see what he's saying. But the first two prequel movies are dog blank. They are horrible. Revenge of the Sith is good. I get what he's saying. There is a climactic moment there and the emotion is earned. The acting is so bad in the prequel movies though, that you just can't get past it. I mean, the dialogue that Anakin says, the love story between him and Padme is atrocious. And okay, John, and I know you agree with me here. The first two of the recent movies are really good. Are really, really good. I love The Force Awakens, and I despised. I don't even remember the last name. What was it? What was the last movie?
Rise of Skywalker, I did not love. I've only seen it once. I didn't love it. So yeah, the corporate thing was hilarious. They're all corporate made. They're gigantic epic sci-fi movies. They have to be corporate made. And remember, the Disney movies are not just those three. You've also got Rogue One and Solo, of course. I liked Rogue One. Solo was fine. I've only seen it once. I have a bit of a soft spot. I have an Emma spot in my heart for The Phantom Menace because I still remember seeing it. And the movie's got some issues, admittedly, but it's got among the best lightsaber fights ever in a Star Wars movie. Darth Maul was a great villain. When that second blade comes out, you gasped. You know you did.
Oh yeah, no. And I still remember watching that as a kid when he gets chopped in half and tumbles down. I was like, how did they do that? He's one part of him's here and the other part of him's there.
This is you discovering CGI in real time.
Yeah.
But anyway, the second prequel movie, no. Yoda was cool, I guess, but no. The third one, I like the third one. I rate that pretty highly in my list, even though it's mostly for the end. The plot doesn't really make a lot of sense. The dialogue is so bad, but that last bit with Anakin and Ewan McGregor is good. Honestly, those movies are kind of saved just by Ewan McGregor being charming. Like, it makes up for the bad acting and dialogue and all of that. He's just kind of a charming guy.
Yeah, it seemed, well, McGregor had experience as an actor, and like all of the other people were first time or close to it. And it seems like George Lucas just didn't care about helping them as a director. And so he just threw them into the snake pit. But yeah, I mean, the recent movies are good, except I would say Return of the Jedi. Geez, what was the last one?
Rise of Skywalker.
Rise of Skywalker. That is probably, that might be the worst one. No. But it's in the bottom three.
Yeah. Well, look, I need to see it again, but I will say, and I guess this is controversial. I don't understand how this is controversial. The Last Jedi is great. It is very, very good. I know
the casino thing. Force Awakens or The Last Jedi better?
Yes.
I like The Force Awakens better, but I like The Last Jedi a lot.
I probably like The Last Jedi more, but The Force Awakens is so clean and so, it's so good. But The Last Jedi's got great lightsaber fight with Kylo and her. That was amazing. That last assault at the end was so good. The battle between Kylo and Luke was great. There's just so much that's good there. Like all of the nerds who watched it and worked so hard to hate it, it just made me sad. Made me sad. I get it. You only want white males in your movies. I get it. But like, it's still good. Just pretend that Rose is a white guy.
Yeah.
And it's great.
Well, what I loved about that movie is that they took risks and they were like, no, maybe Rey is not related to anybody. And it isn't passed down via this divine birthright bloodline. And then J.J. Abrams takes over the last movie and just undoes that. And that killed me because that was a really cool aspect of The Last Jedi. I mean, I saw the last movie, I went to the midnight premiere. I lost my wallet that night, by the way. I think it was stolen out of the theater before the pandemic, you know, when we went to movie theaters. I was so angry leaving that movie. It was the biggest letdown ever, but
anyway. Yeah. Yeah, anyway, so look, Kanye, maybe if he just sticks to pop culture critique, I think we could reintegrate him into this whole thing.
Right.
I don't agree with him about the prequel movies or the corporate nature of these movies. I think that Disney is doing a very good job. Disney's bad in a billion different ways, obviously, but they also made The Mandalorian, so maybe they're not terrible in this area necessarily. And if you, next time you come to LA, by the way, if the pandemic's done, we're gonna go to Disney and we're gonna do the Rise of the Rebellion ride together. That was one of the coolest things I've ever experienced in my life, and I've been all over the world.
Oh,
so
yeah, I'd love to do that. That'd be fun. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's gonna happen. Three years when the pandemic's mostly done.
All right, book it.
Nice. Okay, Emma, I guess that's all the time we have with you for now. Thank you for coming on the show on your last day. I really do appreciate it.
Are you kidding me? I wouldn't have wanted to spend it anywhere else. Thank you so much, John and Brett, for that really thoughtful gift. Obviously, you saw how much it touched me. So,
yeah, everyone. Thank you. We're going to see if we can do that. Follow Emma on Twitter. Go track down the Majority Report wherever it is. On that, I just want to give one caveat on that, though, because I saw a super chat from Chris Chiata who said, "Careful, John, Dragon Squad is flying to the Majority Report. Hashtag Sammy and the Vig. How dare you?
How dare you?
Dare you?"
No, I will only be the second leg of the Vig in this scenario, right?
Okay. There you go. There you go. Yeah. Well, anyway, thank you again. And very excited to see your work going forward. Going to be following very closely. Thank you again for joining us.
Thanks so much.
If you've been paying even a little bit of attention to the news over the past few years, it's probably clear that America has a problem with domestic extremism, radicalization online, and a lot of it is coming from the right. But it's not just an American problem. Many other parts of the world are experiencing something like what we've been experiencing, and perhaps we can learn something from these experiences. And we've got a great source to do a bit of that learning. We want to talk about the book Hate in the Homeland, The New Global Far Right, which was released just this week. And we are very lucky today to be joined by the author, Dr. Cynthia Miller-Idris. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Very glad to have you on. So look, I've recently heard quite a bit about the spread of certain types of, for instance, conspiracy theories internationally, like something like the QAnon movement, which seemed to start very America focused, is now going online. So this idea that the far right radicalizing individuals in many other countries, I think is relevant to a lot of people here in the US. Tell me a little bit about some of what you found in the research for your book.
Yeah, well, the first thing that I think is really important to understand is that this is really a global phenomenon. And when I talk about the far right, which is not a great term, I fully admit, I call it even in the book the best bad term we have available to refer to the phenomenon. But there aren't a lot of great terms. Nobody agrees on these terms across countries, which makes it really complicated. So, but by the far right, I mean, I'm referring not only to the majority of that statistically, which is white supremacist extremism, but also a whole range of anti-government extremism, the incel movement, which is male supremacists or involuntary celibates who lash out against women in violent ways, and even some single actor extremist groups like anti-abortion extremists. So we have a wide range, and a lot of what Americans have seen recently is the growth in, or the more visible growth in anti-government extremism and these militia groups. But the white supremacist fringe has also been growing internationally, and so we've had a 320% rise in right-wing terror globally over the last 5 years. So the things that we're experiencing in the US are very consistent with the kinds of things happening in other countries.
So I'm very glad that you started off with definition there, because I find that to be very interesting. So in the different definitions that you gave, the only one that seems explicitly policy based is abortion related.
Yeah.
So generally, what I assume when we talk about the far right, we're not talking about extreme anti-tax advocates.
There are sovereign citizens, right? So you do have on the far right sovereign citizens and seditionists who just believe that they should not have to pay taxes, for example, that exists. But most of what we're talking about are white supremacist extremists, which is a global movement that believes there's it's a conspiracy theory really called the Great Replacement, believes there's an orchestrated attempt to replace white civilizations with multicultural ones, and calls on young men mostly to take heroic action through violence against that. So we've seen that in the Christchurch terrorist shooting in Oslo in 2011. We saw it in El Paso in this country, in Pittsburgh. We've seen it in a lot of places where these guys think that they're doing a moral thing. They think they're acting heroically to save their people or their race or their civilization or even their nation. And then you have the anti-government fringe, which sometimes overlaps with that, but not always. And the anti-government fringe are folks who believe the government itself is the existential threat, and they should lash out tyrannically, against that tyranny. And that's a lot of what we're seeing in the anti-shelter in place orders and the protests that we're seeing during the pandemic and in the last few weeks.
So you mentioned there the anti-shelter in place protests. Obviously, we've had a lot of that here in America. I honestly don't know. Has that been a big thing overseas? Is it still happening? What areas were the strongest in terms of being opposed to these sort of common sense measures to restrict the flow of COVID?
Yeah, you've definitely seen it. You even see in Germany, I've seen protests where, and I did most of my work for 20 years in Germany. So a lot of my research, two previous books were based in Germany. And then this book is really more global, and a lot of it's rooted in the US, showing how it's in the global context. But in Germany, you see even people comparing mask mandates to slavery. You see protests at government buildings. You see protests in the streets. We're seeing it in the UK and elsewhere around Europe. So there is a little more adherence there, but we have seen the numbers climbing there as well, and people are fatigued and resisting it much as they are in the States. Although I would say in the States it's a little more extreme, also because we have such a heavily armed population, and that is unique to the US. We do not have that kind of gun ownership in other countries, which makes the likelihood of those kinds of protests turning to spontaneous violence much higher here.
So you mentioned one of the big categories that it's encapsulated within the far right is this white nationalist or white supremacist movement. And so I want to learn a little bit more about that, because obviously there's been racism and white supremacy for a long time. So yeah. What is it specifically that is different about this? Is it the link to individual acts of terrorism that you implied there? What is it that's making it different than just, you know, racism that's been throughout humanity for as long as we've been a species?
Absolutely, and it's really important to explain too. And this, it seemed logical to say this, but it's not as logical as you'd think within the world of terrorists, you know, counter-terrorist work. But you can't combat white supremacist extremism without understanding that it rests on a foundation of white supremacy or kind of more ordinary forms of racism. That's there and that's present. But what you see in the extremist fringe, which I study, is taking that kind of, you know, more ordinary forms of racism, elevating it to a level of extreme, you know, existential threat. That's really the heart of this, believing that there's a conspiracy, that there's an orchestrated effort by elites or by Jews or by Muslims, depending on which form of the conspiracy it takes, to create what they call white genocide in this country, which is the belief that white people will end up on reservations like Native Americans, that they will be eradicated. I mean, it is an extreme fringe set of beliefs, but that mobilizes and motivates extreme violence. And that is exactly the conspiracy. It's called the Great Replacement. When you saw those young men in Charlottesville, you know, marching across the college campus with tiki torches, they were chanting, "You will not replace us," or "Jews will not replace us." That's that conspiracy theory. So it is a mobilizing, motivating conspiracy theory that is different and much more extreme than regular, you know, ordinary white supremacy, which has to be present in order for that to exist. But the reason why I say it's, you know, it seems logical is that a lot of the way that people have approached combating terrorism or white supremacist extremism in this country is a pivot from the attempts to combat Islamist extremism after 9/11. And I think sometimes they miss that or overlook that. That underlying white supremacy is, you know, has to be, you know, combated as well. So it's, so it is a, it's a different beast, and also has some similarities with Islamic forms, Islamist forms of extremism. But I think you can't treat it in exactly the same way, and you have to look at the social context and the ways that it's, you know, foundational in other ways in this country as well.
Okay, so I think that's a great description of how it's different. So I guess the follow-up then is why? Why is it happening? Is this about, you know, the rise of parties that are pushing this sort of thing? Is it individuals like an election of like a Donald Trump or a Putin or whoever? Is this a technological, you know, thing? Why are we seeing this suddenly sprouting up in so many different countries?
Well, there's several different things happening at the same time that kind of create a perfect storm for growth to happen in white supremacist extremism. And one is the ease with which these ideas have spread. And a lot of that is that online ecosystem. So, you know, where people used to think of any form of extremism, but especially white supremacist extremism in this country, as kind of like a tumor, like a few bad cells that could be isolated, that were limited to backwoods militia or an Aryan Brotherhood prison gang. And as long as you kept your kids and your people away from those people, you know, you're not gonna encounter those bad cells, right? If you think of it more like, and I promise I was using this metaphor before the pandemic, but you know, if you think of it more like a virus, a contagious virus that has can reach people who have vulnerabilities and actually spreads online, spreads in other contexts. Then you start to see how people can encounter it in really different ways today. And that's a lot of what this book is about, is how people, you know, might encounter it in an online, you know, cooking show. There's a, you know, there's a neo-Nazi vegan cooking show in Germany where these guys show recipes, cook recipes while sharing ideology, right? It's you know, DIY shows or other places where people might ordinarily go and then get recommended through an algorithm to watch another video like this and then encounter one where there's embedded white supremacist ideology being shared. So there's a creep into the mainstream that's deliberate and intentional on the part of these groups trying to share their ideology, because they've decided to go meet people where they are instead of waiting for them to come find them in isolated places. And so that's one way that this, you know, growth has is facilitated by the online ecosystem that allows that kind of spread.
So then combating it, is it about tech platforms taking it more seriously or making changes? Have we had it? I've seen Facebook and Twitter have changed a bit about how you can share information during the election, things like this. Have we seen any changes that have seemed to be successful? And if not just the tech platforms, what is supposed to combat this? Is it government? Is it society? Yeah. What does the evidence show so far?
So I think, you know, it's of course it's important to hold social media companies accountable and hold tech platforms accountable, and they do have to pay attention to what's going on and shut down the spread wherever they can. But my view is, after watching young people in schools for such a long time in Europe, where, you know, German schools would ban the number 88 from display because it's the eighth letter of the alphabet, which is a code for HH, is a code for Heil Hitler. They would ban the display of that number, and kids showed up wearing shirts that said 100 minus 12 or 87 plus 1, right? Like, there's always gonna be a game playing in a way that makes it even more fun, like binge drinking, right? It's a game playing coding way that if the second you ban something like the Boogaloo as a code, it turns into Big Luau, or it turns into Big Igloo. Like, there's a constant, and it's like a whack-a-mole situation. Mm-hmm. And so it can't be the end solution to intervention. It has to be part of the, you know, part of the story, deplatforming these guys, making sure that they can't raise money in the same ways, cutting off the ways to communicate. But that can't be the fundamental solution. I think we have to address it much more like a public health crisis and try to help people understand, what is it like when you encounter, how do you recognize scapegoating as a tactic? How do you recognize online manipulation or propaganda, white supremacist propaganda, so that when your kids or your nephews or nieces encounter it, especially young people, I think, are vulnerable to this, they know what it is. They recognize that manipulation for what it is and know how to go talk to a trusted adult and steer away from it.
You might have actually gotten into the area of my next question, but based on your research, what are members of the media, people like me, what are we getting wrong when we talk about these sorts of things? Or perhaps government, what do they fundamentally misunderstand about this that might be making it harder to combat the sort of radicalization your book looks into?
I think one of the things that the government and maybe the media too has focused on very heavily are these questions about how and why, right? How do these groups organize, and why are people attracted to it? Those are important questions. But I think if we start to understand it's not only groups that are organizing this, but a lot of self-radicalizing individuals who just kind of encounter this information, I actually think the more important set of questions are where and when people encounter this information for the first time. Where do the gateways begin? How do they encounter them in their ordinary lives, in everyday spaces? And when you start to look at that, and this book looks at the mixed martial arts as a place that's been targeted, at college campuses as places that have been targeted for propaganda and misinformation, at things like online cooking shows or t-shirts that are sold that have slogans like, you know, my favorite color is white, but on a purple t-shirt. So it has that kind of plausible deniability. What does that mean? Is it a racist statement or not? You know, and so, and then that comes walking at you down the street, or your friend has it on, what does it mean, right? And those kinds of symbols and those insidious ways that they reach out and connect to people in their everyday lives, I think those are some important questions to pay attention to if we want to actually think about how to interrupt. And so not the tactics are important, the organizational strategies are important, the vulnerabilities are important, but that can't be the whole story of how we interrupt it.
Well, I really appreciate that. This is fascinating, as fascinating perhaps as it is fundamentally disturbing. The book is Hate in the Homeland, The New Global Far Right, available right now. Dr. Cynthia Miller Idris, we really appreciate you joining us and breaking down your research.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.